This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 18th of December 2009. Joining me today for our monthly update is Bob Chapman, formerly the largest silver and gold stockbroker in the world and currently the man behind the International Forecaster, a monthly newsletter on international financial, economic, political, and social matters. He's been exposing the true nature of our political and financial reality for over five decades now. And Mr. Chapman, it is an honor to have you back on the program once again.
Well, gee, thank you very much, and I love doing your program, so this is terrific.
Excellent. Well, I'm excited to have you on again because, as the listeners may recall, the last time we had our monthly update was just as the ClimateGate scandal was breaking. And, of course, since then, we've been watching the implosion of the man-made climate change hoax, which is... It was always intended as the linchpin and the nucleus of a new embryonic world government. So coming as that scandal did right on the eve of Copenhagen, it's not really an exaggeration to say ClimateGate was something of a miracle. And I'm proud that the Corbett Report has been one of the alternative news outlets that's been on top of this story from the beginning. And listeners will know by now that I've launched a new website, climategate.tv, to keep up with all things related to climate science and the Copenhagen conference and carbon eugenics in general. But given that we've been undergoing such tectonic shifts on the political scene in recent weeks, I'm happy to have the chance to pick your brain about what this all means. So let's start with Copenhagen. What's your take on this UNFCCC convention going on in Denmark at the moment, and what do you see as the likely fallout from this, both short and long term?
Well, I think that the agreement that's been made is... to start paying off the third world nations to go along with one world government. That's essentially what it amounts to. Fortunately, as far as the trading of carbon credits in Europe is concerned, there's a major scandal going on, and it's being investigated by the Euro police. And I think it's going to stop that whole action in its tracks, which is another positive. The very idea that Western nations will give, at the beginning, $10 billion a year to third world nations is ridiculous, and it's going to grow substantially larger over the years. This sort of thing has to be passed by the U.S. House and Senate, and it will not pass. And we've already heard that from Senator Imhoff, among others. And so with that said, that will force the president to try to end run the Congress by sticking it into another category, such as scientific or climate or EPA, whatever they use. And then there's going to be a clash with the Congress, and hopefully it will come after the next election, because the composition, I think, of Congress is going to change dramatically. The Democrats have made absolute fools out of themselves. And a good example is the stalling of cap and trade in the Senate, and 2,045 pages of a report of a bill that nobody knows outside of some secret meeting held by Harry Reid what's in it, and they want them to vote for it. And the Republicans are in revolt, and some of the Democrats as well. And the Republicans have said that they're going to filibuster a financial bill until the Democrats drop this secrecy thing regarding health care reform. So there's all sorts of interplay things going on in Washington right now. And as you said, the exposure of the emails in regard to the academic fraud that was created over the years in regard to global warming is a miracle. And it was very propitious that the, well, we have to call them crooks, on the carbon exchange in Europe, which has already been going for several years. And incidentally, there is such an exchange functioning in the United States as well. The main players are Goldman Sachs, Hank Paulson, and a fellow named Al Gore. And Al Gore's got his fingers in everything. There's a whole bunch of other groups he's associated with where he'll make billions and trillions. And the whole thing is all about money and all about taxing people, all about cutting down world population, all about people control worldwide, all about taxation. Because even though third world nations are going to get money from the first world, everybody's going to pay about a 20% tax, and the UN's not going to run it anymore. It's going to be run by the World Bank. And so if cap and trade were to be passed, the money would go to Goldman Sachs and Paulson and Gore, and they would take what they want, and the rest would go to the World Bank. And you know, they'd take what they want, and there'd be very little left. It's just a giant scam.
Well, that's right. And just to flesh out a couple of the things that you were mentioning there for the listeners, the World Bank IMF control of this new funding mechanism for the embryonic world government created through this Copenhagen Agreement came out during the so-called Danish text, which was a draft agreement that was reached earlier this week, which proposed funneling all the funds instead of through the UN, as the developing world was expecting, instead putting it all through the World Bank and IMF. And of course, everyone in the developing world knows that that's basically a death sentence for the developing world, because the World Bank and IMF are not their friends. And also the Sydney Morning Herald is now reporting, as you said, that the agreement that apparently has been reached as of today, December 18th, involves $10 billion a year in so-called climate reparations from the industrialized world to the developing world in 2010, ramping up to $50 billion in 2015 and $100 billion annually by 2020. So, yes, very, very incredible, disturbing, and seismic shifts going on at the moment. And unfortunately, there's no doubt that there are still many people who have fallen for this man-made climate change hoax, and they genuinely believe they're saving the Earth by limiting that vile, life-giving CO2 gas. But there's no doubt that the rumblings and the stirrings of dissent that we've seen brewing about this faulty pseudoscience over the years has become a full-on tidal wave, and it is crashing through decades of carefully constructed myths and hoaxes about drowning polar bears and the end of the world. So, while I certainly don't think that ClimateGate alone is single-handedly going to derail an agenda in which the oligarchs have invested so much time and so much money and so much of their political capital, would you agree with my assessment that they are listing and reeling at the moment, and that they are most vulnerable right now if only we can find some effective way of striking out at their lies and their myths?
Well, I agree with you completely, and I've discussed this in other programs, and that is that we do have them on the run. We have done a lot of good work on talk radio and through the internet, and, you know, I'm doing 30 programs a week, and I'm pounding them, and there are others like myself. I would wish that there were 100,000 more doing what we're doing. But it takes a certain character to do what we do, and we can't expect everybody else to share the engagement of the enemy as we do. But we're going to win. It's going to be very painful. We're going to have a world depression, and there's not a lot we can do about that because it's been arranged that way. But out of the other side, I think we'll have a stronger, more traditional kind of government in each and every country, and I think people will have learned again that they should really be happy with the freedom that they have and be active to keep it that way.
Well, that's right. I think you're exactly right in that assessment, but unfortunately, I think that's a lesson that each generation has to learn afresh. But hopefully we can once again learn that very important lesson. And we need to keep in mind that the oligarchs are not going to stop moving ahead with their agenda at this point. So we need to continue fighting their moves towards global government and the centralization of control. So on that topic, I note that in the most recent edition of The Forecaster, you outline plans by the Gulf states to form a monetary union with a single currency. Tell us about that.
Well, I think it's been a long time coming. I think what's kept them back from doing it was the fact that the U.S. and Great Britain had exchanged their military protection of the Gulf states, and in turn, the Gulf states agreed to deliver oil at reasonable prices to both nations. And I think that arrangement is coming to an end. And so, because the dollar has been just utterly destroyed by the people who have run the United States since August the 15th, 1971, when we went off the gold standard, and the dollar needs to be relieved of its responsibility of being the world reserve currency because it's been debauched. And so the Arabs are doing a normal thing. They are forming a dinar for their group, and they're going to use a basket of currencies at the beginning, eventually float the dinar as a regular currency. And I think that you're going to have others who are large producers and buyers of oil and gas do the same thing, and that would be Russia, India, China, Venezuela, Brazil, as they're called, the BRIC countries. They're all going to stop over a 2 to 3 year period. We'll say a 2 year period. They're going to stop using dollars, and that'll cripple a dollar. And so the rally that you see taking place in the dollar from 74 in the USDX to about 78 is all generated by the people in Washington and Wall Street. And the reason they're doing that is they want to try to get the dollar up because they know it's going to get smashed. And they're trying to keep it from getting smashed as long as possible. Dollar could go a little bit higher. No one knows. And I know that the U.S. government is massively short gold and silver bullion, as well as the shares. And in fact, the share shorts even show up in the statements of Goldman Sachs. They're short about 10 million shares of individual stocks. And usually that makes up about 5% of the outstanding shares in the short side. And short means you're going to bet a stock is going to go down. And so we as American citizens are fighting our government every day because they're in supporting the stock market as well. And there is no free market. And that's what's so important about Ron Paul's 1207, which is the bill to investigate the Fed, which was passed in that dreadful financial bill. But anyway, it was passed. Now we got to get it passed in the Senate. And then we can go in and find out what the working group in financial markets, the Treasury and the Fed, have been doing in all the markets. And they know that's coming. They're going to fight it, but I don't think they're going to win. And perhaps 3 or 4 months from now, what's going to happen is that the public's going to start finding out what's going on. And they're not going to be very happy about it. And I think during the coming year, this control of markets by the United States government and the privately owned Federal Reserve, I think, is going to end. The market is under tremendous pressure right now because the Fed has said that by February 1st, they're going to be out of all of these market support operations. They're pulling back the TARP funds. They wanted to remove the TARP funds from the system, but that luxury is not going to be given to them because the Treasury wants $150 to $200 billion in further purchases of Treasury paper, and already the Fed is buying half of the Treasury paper, and that's what they admit to. Who knows how much has been bought through the swap arrangements that they've had with the five major European nations, including Japan and Canada. And when that money comes back, which it's going to, $700 billion, the Treasury wants $200 billion, and our president jumps up and says, I want the rest because I need it in the economy. Otherwise, the economy is going to go down. And he's right. And so they probably will get a good piece of that, if not all of it. And so that will extend the life of the economy as we know it now, probably to about the end of the year, if not into the first quarter of 2011. And that will be after the election. That's a prima facie excuse for this money as well, as saying, hey, look, we want to get reelected, and you've got to do this for us. And, you know, that's the tone of thinking. And so that's the way I think things are going to play out. But the tremendous risk is being taken by nations all over the world by withdrawing support from their markets and economies. And I don't think once they start pulling the money and the flow of credit out of these markets and out of these economies, all of them, they're not going to be able to get it back. That's when we're going to go into deep deflationary depression. And when is that? Probably about 2, maybe 2.5 years from now. So get ready, because that's where we're headed. They have decided to take the move to remove the excess liquidity, which is about $13 trillion in round figures. And they pull that out, the whole thing's going down the chute. And in the meantime, they will continue to build some forms of liquidity, especially in the monetization of treasuries, trying to hold that up as long as possible. And that's going to be very inflationary. So I'm looking for 14% inflation next year. And inflation right now is above 7 1/8% this week. The CPI figures showed us that inflation is 2.4%. That's their official version. And, of course, it's incorrect. But I think we can easily reach 14% next year.
Well, put that into perspective for people. From a historical standpoint, where does that put us?
It puts you at the same place as we were in August of 1979. And for a year and a half after that, gold went berserk in those terms of those days. I know I was there. And we're going to see the same thing. For gold to reflect inflation alone, never mind all of the other things that have gone on since 1980, gold would have to be $6,700 an ounce. John Williams, eminent economist, feels it should be $7,150 an ounce, and I'm not going to argue with him. It's a long way from here, and that's the real world, and that's where it's going. And there's nobody going to stop it, particularly government and the Federal Reserve. And as I said, if we get the legislation passed, what's going to happen is that they are going to be stopped from doing what they're doing. I believe that there will be legislation overriding the executive order signed by President Reagan in August of 1988, and that will end participation with some minor exceptions, minor exception being in supporting the dollar. And other than that, I think they're going to be stopped from doing what they're doing. And I think there is going to be an enormous fallout when I see Goldman Sachs employees throughout the world arming themselves, and it's happening in other firms too, because they think the public's going to come after them. And so it's going to be a rocky road down the road here, and it could get violent.
That's right. That's unfortunate, but I think that that is definitely a very good possibility. And that's a very telling story about the Goldman Sachs workers apparently being armed, just in case there are armed revolts against them. Very, very telling story. But you mentioned that, of course, the plunge protection team has been propping up stock markets artificially for 2 decades now. And as you say, it's like a keeping a juggling act, keeping all the balls in the air. Eventually, they're going to have to come down. And it's just a question of how that happens and when it happens. But it can't be that much longer, one would assume. And you also also, of course, mentioned the Paul Grayson Amendment, which was a put on as a rider to a terrible piece of financial legislation, but was passed. So it was a bittersweet victory. Tell people a little bit more about that.
Well, they were certainly strange bedfellows. Paulson, Grayson is a very bright man. I don't agree with his ideas, but in this case, I do. I don't know why he was in the play, so to speak, but maybe he genuinely sees what we do in that aspect. But the bill will allow us to look into what the Fed has done 6 months before. So if the bill was passed today, we would go back to June 18th, 19th, and then before that, we could see what the Fed did. And that's real good, and I'll tell you why. Because this goes back to 1913. These people have been doing this for a long, long time. And you're going to see a pattern of how they've caused these cycles, both good and bad, within the economy and financially. And you're going to see how rigged that the whole thing was from the very beginning when the legislation was passed. And the legislation was passed because the people in the Treasury Department after the Civil War did dreadful. I mean, we had a depression in the early 70s that was worse than the one in the 1930s. And then we had panics in the 80s, the 90s, 1905. It was dreadful. And so of course, the Fed hasn't done any better. They just, the people in the Fed and the banks and all of their connections have made billions and billions of dollars in that process. And they've done the same thing, only they didn't do it because they were inept. They did it because they planned it that way. And so we're going to find out who they lent money to, which is a secret. And these things should not be secret. We're going to find out what the money was used for, what the collateral was, how much was allowed for the collateral. In other words, if the collateral was really somewhere at 20 cents on the dollar, were they allowing 80? And also, we should be able to access the emails and the telephone conversations between the Federal Reserve and banks, and particularly the brokerage firms on Wall Street, because they're running on inside information. They know what's going on before we do. I worked in Wall Street for 28 years, and insider training is rampant. It happens a million times a day. It's incredible. And I know there's a court case right now on a divorce in New York where the wife, because in a divorce, because she wasn't given part of the profits on insider trading by her husband, she's gone to the authorities and told them what he did and how he did it and how he lied to Congress. And so this might set a pattern for women who get divorced in Wall Street, so to speak. And this is very important because they have a tendency in Wall Street to have a wife, have a family, and then they get tired of the first wife and want a trophy wife. And when they do this trophy wife thing, the first wife is not very happy about that. And so I think a lot more of them are going to pull the chain on these guys. And so it's an interesting addition to what's going on and probably will go on with the exposures as a result of what has happened with the Federal Reserve. If it's not passed, the public will throw their hands in the air and you'll likely have revolution.
That's right. And I guess it's important to keep in perspective that it sometimes does come from strange quarters and things that you wouldn't expect, where we get some of the most interesting information and things being released and different things added to the mix. So it's important to keep our eyes on some of those factors, that those X factors that we can't really calculate, but the human factors.
The untoward events, and you pointed it out earlier in the program, the miracle of the exposure of the emails between the players in regard to climate control. And they had to have come from the inside. Sure, the Russians were the ones that put them out through their server, but to me, that doesn't mean anything. It's kind of payback for them because they lost as the Soviet Union. Of course, they're better off today than they've ever been, but it was a tough road, and people in the world don't understand what they've been through. It was terrible. But anyway, it was a miracle that that information came out. I said, I think that somebody got their consciousness said to them, I can't let this happen, and they exposed it. And eventually it will take the whole thing down.
Exactly, and we have to, I hope someday that we can discover who did that so that we can get it on the record that it was a whistleblower, it was leaked from the inside, as it surely must have been, because I don't believe there was a hacker who went through 11 years of correspondence in order to find the few thousand emails and things that just happened to relate to things that had been requested under Freedom of Information. This was clearly a file that had been prepared for Freedom of Information request, but had obviously not been released, and it was clearly a whistleblower on the inside who did decide to release it. So we have someone to thank for that, and whoever it was, it is one of those X Factor events that we can't predict, and we have to remember that we are dealing with real human beings on the inside of these organizations and structures, and if we can reach out to those real human beings and wake them up, then we have incredible power to strike out against the system. So again, that's just an incredible story and something that we can't really predict, but we can only hope will continue to occur and will perhaps escalate as things in the world start to escalate. But turning our attention just a little bit more to the international situation once again, I noticed that you linked in the recent newsletter to an article by Ambrose Evans-Pritchard in The Telegraph about Greece revolting against the EMU by refusing to go along with the wage deflation leech cure. And I've also posted a guest article in the article section on CorbettReport.com by Ellen Brown about Greece and Latvia and Iceland's rebellion against the EU and the IMF. So could you break this situation down for the listeners and tell us about the importance of the precedent that's being set in revolting against the EU and the IMF and their horrible, horrible policies that are inflicted on countries that become debtor nations?
Well, the idea is to keep them in perpetual bondage to interest payments and control from the outside. And the Latin American countries have already revolted against it and paid off their bills and it won't have anything to do with the IMF. First of all, when the European Union was formed as the European Common Market, it was an unnatural bringing together of perhaps as many as 200 or more tribes. Now, I know that's hard for people to understand. They think there's no tribes in Europe, and they're wrong. There are tribes. People have evolved in Europe in tribal fashion. Let's take Germany. You go to Munich, and they speak Bayerisch. You go to Stuttgart, they speak Schwabisch. In Frankfurt and Hamburg, they speak Plattdeutsch. And why? Because it was an evolution of tribes. So what they've tried to do, and the same thing is in France and the other countries. I mean, if you come from Marseille, you're looked down upon if you're looked at by a Parisian or someone from Lyon. The point is this. They tried to put together a whole bunch of tribes and it doesn't work. And that was the wrong genesis in the first place. But, of course, those who want world government, they're willing to do anything, and they just don't care. And the second thing that they did was that when they formed the Eurozone, they had one interest rate to fit all. Disastrous. Because the needs of Germany are totally different than those of Spain or Greece. And so what happened was, in recent years, because interest rates were unnaturally low for we'll call struggling economies such as Greece, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, they overdid it. just like Americans did in the real estate market. And in spending, particularly governmental spending, never mind personal and corporate spending, and so they all got themselves in trouble. And so what the Greeks are saying here is, look, you get us into this. We're not going to allow the IMF to come in and dictate to us what we're going to do with the World Bank or anybody else. And you're going to have to live with it. And if you don't want to bail us out, that's fine. We'll leave. And we're going to go bankrupt. And that will happen. Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Iceland, Hungary, Romania. And by the time we get through, it's going to sweep across Europe. Europe is in deep doo-doo. They got a problem. And, of course, the French and German manufacturers and the Dutch have done well, and they don't like their profits falling. They complain about this, that, and the other thing. These chronic complainers, actually. And so the euro and Europe have very, very difficult problems to overcome. And there's no mechanism within the European Central Bank to handle this. They're not allowed to go in and bail a country out, like Greece. And will one of the members unilaterally do that? I don't know. Can they do that? I don't know. I don't think so. And so what's going on in those countries is unusual and monumental. The euro is not overpriced. It's underpriced. Europe in the recent years have had their economic problems, and that leaves England out because they're a basket case. And they're going down. There's just no question. And the direction that's going to be taken in Europe is one of separatism, and you're seeing that already. And so you may see eventually in 2 or 3 or 4 years a breakup of the European Union, in particularly the currency, the euro. If you poll the Germans, which is the leading European country economically and financially, and these figures are poll figures, but they're old. 71% of women and 69% of men in Germany want the Deutschmark back. And they don't like the European Union one bit because their balance of payment surplus is subsidizing the rest of the 16 members in this Eurozone because most of them are running deficits, and they don't like that. And there's many other things as well, particularly cultural. You know, the envisionment was that people would be crossing country lines, and if you lived in Maastricht and in Belgium, you would go over to Lyon in France and get a job, similar language, and it didn't work that way. People didn't go from Spain to Frankfurt to work, and so on and so forth. And the reason for that is the cultural divide. Now, yes, there's a lot of people from North Africa and Turkey in Europe, Muslims, but they went there because the opportunities just weren't there for them in their own countries. But people who lived in Europe for their lives and their ancestors have lived there, they weren't interested in crossing over from Oporto in Portugal to Munich and have to learn a new language and go through all that. And who could they talk to and what could they do? And there was no familiarity. There were no other Portuguese to talk to. And so it never worked. And it just shows you trying to conglomerate people who have lived the centuries as people, different tribes, so to speak, is impossible. And I wrote about this years ago. And so now we're paying, the Europeans are going to pay the price. And it's going to be upsetting, and it's going to change the course of Europe.
Well, you bring up some interesting points there, because it certainly does seem that just as they're bringing in their Lisbon Treaty to really consolidate their tyrannical grasp on the European continent, it seems the European project itself is falling apart as the peripheral nations start to realize they're really being used and played by the biggies, Germany and France and the others. And in the exact same way that I suppose that the Copenhagen conference is kind of a move of desperation, just as ClimateGate is starting to break and people are really starting to realize the hoax that's been perpetrated, now they're moving to bring about their world government based on that hoax. So there are incredible bright points of resistance out there that are really delegitimizing every move that the oligarchs are making exactly as they're making it. So this can't help but be a positive sign overall. And the question is simply whether we have the will and the political capital to push this, to push all of these points and push all of these buttons across through to the mainstream. Well, Bob, we've covered a lot of ground so far today, but is there anything of pressing importance that you wanted to cover that we haven't gotten to?
I did touch on the movement that's going on upward in the dollar, and the minor correction in gold that we've seen, about $125 an ounce, which is nothing. But the stock market is going to be losing a lot of capital when these TARP funds are out of the hands of these banks, brokerage houses, and insurance companies. There were seven insurance companies that received over $1 billion each, which tells me they were all bankrupt. And they got to give the money back as well. And so this gambling, and that's what they did with part of these funds in the stock market, is what's put it up there. And so this lack of funding is going to bring it down. Another factor, which is enough to make you regurgitate, it's so bad, it's disgraceful, is the FASB, Financial Standard Accounting, I forget the name of it, and they came out the other day, and I had it in the International Forecaster, and instead of implementing the end of two sets of books for all American corporations, if you can believe that, which was allowed for 2 years, and the mark-to-market of investments, they backed off on it, on the banks. They said banks are different, and so the banks can go do that still. And so all of the bank books are a lie. They get two sets of books, and they're not going to be made for years to come to tell you really what their assets are, which is insanity. I mean, how can they do that? Well, they're doing it arbitrarily and capriciously, and they're doing it in conjunction with the elites who run our country. And so that was terrible. And then the Bank for International Settlements comes up and says the same thing on Basel II and Basel III. They didn't include anybody else but the banks. And so people who are involved in as shareholders in bank stocks, good luck, because they're bankrupt. And they're trying to put a facade on by not allowing the true information to come out for the betterment of the country, of course. Of course, it's really for the betterment of the bankers. And so our corrupt system is still corrupt. And they're going to try to play it along and play it out to stay in power. And you know something? It isn't going to work, because we're going to expose what they're doing. We're going to hammer on them every day that their books are Mickey Mouse. They're not real. And we still got a major problem. And what's going to happen to all of these bad assets that the Federal Reserve has bought for 80 cents in the dollar that are worth 20 cents in the dollar? Are they going to be handed over to the American public? And the answer is yes. And how big is that loss? Probably maybe $2 trillion. We can add that to the number that the investigator, the IG, Investigator General, one of some 15 in the government, said about the possibility of debt loss by the Treasury and the Fed was $23.7 trillion dollars. We're going to end up, as taxpayers, probably covering something on the order of maybe $15, $20 trillion there. I mean, the whole thing is madness, and nobody seems to care. And the public has got to wake up. They have to educate themselves, or they're going to lose everything. If this thing slips into a deflationary depression, the only people who are going to make out are people with gold and silver related assets and foreign bonds and countries that won't go under, like Switzerland, Australia, Canada, Norway. And there's not many more than that, I'll tell you, because everybody has done the same thing that the bankers in America have done and the governments have done and the central banks have done. They've all got the same problem. Look at the percentage of debt of GDP. I mean, it's astronomical. I can't remember the figures. I wrote them this morning. It's going to stretch anywhere from 85% of GDP to 277% of GDP to Japan. And we just can't keep on going that way. And that's why I think a year to a year and a half from now, there'll be another big meeting like the Smithsonian, the Plaza Accord, the Louvre Accord of 85 and 87. All the currencies will be revalued and devalued against one another. A new international unit will be formed, probably of G20 countries on a weighted basis, probably with a 10 to 15% gold backing. And I think there'll be an official devaluation of the dollar. And I think there'll be a default on debt by all countries with one another of about two-thirds of the debt. One-third they'll have to pay back to each other. How that will affect Americans within America remains to be seen. Logic tells us if you had a $100,000 loan, the payback would drop to $32,500. But there's no logic in Washington. And this would be another way of the Illuminati breaking down the economic and financial structure of the United States and other countries as well who will be devaluing as well. And so it's not going to be easy. There's going to be a lot of things that you don't like, and a lot of people who don't do the right thing financially, who do have wealth, are going to lose it all. We saw it during the 1930s and the 1870s. We saw it in Weimar Germany, and which happened before, actually, the Depression in the United States. And that was planned as well, incidentally. Hitler was born at Versailles, believe me. And so this is where we're generally headed. And you better keep your wits about you, and you better lean on Washington hard, all of them, to get the kind of legislation that we need to survive.
Right, absolutely. Well, now is the time, while we have this moment before the storm really hits, to wake up and get ourselves educated by finding real sources of news and information in order to really be informed about what's going on and then come to a true understanding of our situation and how we can fight back. So on that note, tell people how they can get their hands on the International Forecaster newsletter.
Well, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. We publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays, usually runs around 40 pages each time. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the Internet. And you can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. You can email us, and we answer everybody's questions. The email address is bob@intforecaster.com. That's bob@intforecaster.com. Or you can call 800-375-4188. That's toll-free, 800-375-4188, and just ask for a copy. The copy you will receive is the last one that we published. And all the things that you need to know every week are in that publication.
They certainly are, Bob Chapman. It's a pleasure as always, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you very much. I will see you in January.